Food Talk with Mike Colomeco is brought to you by Cento at cento.com, King Arthur at kingarthurflower.com, Cola Vida at colavita.com, and Wines of Portugal at winesofportugal.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Mike Colomeco's Food Talk. Here we're live. This is second show, season two, live from Morgantown. That's what they call this place. That's right. That's what. If you're hip, you see, you know that stuff. That is the Morgan stop on the L train in what's masquerading as Bushwick, Brooklyn these days.
Come on now.
Oh, I'm not going
to. The heart of Brooklyn. Stop.
This is the epicenter of hipsterdom. This is the church of Brooklyn. Cool. We're in the pews in the house. This is it. If you want to be at the cool table, you got to be here in Bushwick. That's what I'm saying.
Right.
So I want to give a shout out to a restaurant. I try to go to a new restaurant every week because that's my gig. And I went to it's actually a recycled older restaurant. Nick Morgenstern's the owner. Nick's an interesting guy. Pastry guy that morphed into restaurant ownership. He had the General Green in Brooklyn. Now he's got that great ice cream joint down off the Bowery called Morgenstern's. And if you haven't been, get there. The ice cream's insane. But he had a restaurant called Goat Town, and I forget, it was a literary reference. Don't ask me why it was called Goat Town. Do you know why it's called Goat Town? Yeah, he's doing the goat. That's the goat. But Goat Town went the way of goats. It didn't make it somehow. So he closed it, and he reopened it as Gigi's, and it's kind of cool. I liked it. We went to dinner there the other night, and almost everything comes out of a big old Bludgett pizza deck oven. So they've got pizza, they've got appetizers they throw in there, wilted stuff that they throw in there, and then a roast meat of the night, and it was veal shoulder that night. It was good. I liked it. It wasn't expensive either. Two of us ate there with a decent bottle of wine, and it was $100. That doesn't happen much in Manhattan anymore. It doesn't happen much in Brooklyn anymore. So, guests today. We had to juggle the order because of timeliness. My first guest is Chef Michael Lomonaco, a native of Brooklyn, a New Yorker to the bone, born in South Brooklyn way back in the day, probably went to one of those technical cooking. What cooking school did you go to? I shouldn't joke.
New York City College of Technology.
I'm telling you, I had that. I remember that. You did. You didn't go to like the CIA and shell out major moho money. CIA now is like 70, 80 grand. Don't even get me started.
No.
So you went to like Brooklyn Tech, worked your way up, and just a few of the places. I mean, Mike was the chef at the 21 Club. Michael was the chef at Windows on the World, and it's an old story we won't go into today, but only by the grace of God, he got his eyes checked the morning of 9/11, or he would have been upstairs. But he was the chef for the entire kit and caboodle. And now he runs a wonderful modern chop house in the Time Warner Center called Michael Lomonaco's Porter House. It is one of my favorite steakhouse, modern steakhouse
Thank
iterations
you.
In the city. And I remember this, Michael, when you first opened up. I was in between apartments in New York. I'd just gotten that gig at WOR called Food Talk. And I was living at the New York Athletic Club, where I'm a member. They have rooms for members upstairs, and they cut me a good rate so I could stay there five nights a week. And as you know, they don't have kitchens in those rooms. So I was kind of forced to eat out every meal. And you had just opened up, basically. You kind of were just...
8 years ago. 8 years.
Yeah, yeah. So I would come into your place. A lot of times I wouldn't even go to the dining room. I would go into the bar area by the entrance, sit at one of those little tables on a stool, and what I was doing was just ordering side dishes. Because I know your steak's going to be great. You're buying great prime meat. That's not... So I... The collard greens, the polenta, the Swiss chard, the whatever you had on the menu.
Yeah.
I just ordered side dish after side dish, and you nailed them all. And then one day somebody recognized me, maybe one of your girls pouring wine or something, and the jig was out. But I love the place. I really do.
That's so nice.
Try and go there
Thank
once
you so much.
We had that... We took some friends there a couple of months ago, right? The guy that owns that big meat provision house out on Long Island. He's got some good steak.
Yes.
You get a hold of him, Sergenti?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, because he sells Peter Luger, he sells Keen's, he's got a dry-aged thing that's sick. So you're here for two reasons. One is I want to talk about you and your story, because it's a great New York story, and talk about your restaurant, what you're up to these days. And if you want to chime in,
Feel free, chef. Why? Because you're here, man.
We got our chef de cuisine with us,
chef
our executive
cuisine.
Chef.
And the truth.
Executive chef,
right.
Mike Amirati.
And he's the guy who puts the whites on every day, ties an apron on, and works his butt off. Expedites, works
all
the
true.
Pass, gets on the line. I mean, as once,
can't deny it. All
once
true.
You're up to where Michael LaMonaco is, you can wear the suit and the tie, and you go shake hands. And
yeah, that's just how it is.
You know what I'm saying? Check the temperature on the fryer later. Make sure stuff's clean.
Yeah.
And then eat out a lot. No, that's not true. So talk about this. This when is it? Is it this weekend or next weekend, the New York Food and Wine Festival?
Well, it's next weekend, beginning on October 16th to the 19th.
Is this the sixth or seventh?
Yeah, it is the seventh year of the Food Network New York City Wine and Food Festival, you know. Seventh year.
Say that
year.
Again, because you got that correct.
It's the Food Network New York City Wine and Food Festival.
Is there tied awesome. Into Food and Wine magazine as well?
Oh, that was a loaded question. No.
I don't
no,
know. Or just
no,
the, so it's just
no.
the TV. Just
and it grew out of, you know, the South Beach Food
it
and
did,
Wine.
It was, what's his name?
That's right. Lee Schrager.
Lee Schrager. Who I can picture. So right. Lee Schrager started in South Beach. It was huge.
That's right. It's exactly right. And here in New York City, you know, we're not a big festival town. There are smaller cities that are big festival towns. But this is a real festival that yeah. I think is a huge success. And, you know, what's really important is that it's the seventh annual. There are 110 events throughout the weekend. We're doing one of them. And 100% of their net proceeds from the event go to Share Our Strength, go to Food Bank for New York City.
That was
City.
My
and
question.
That's important.
Can I tell you something? And I hate to do this, but I asked your PR person who helped, you know,
yes.
arrange this.
Yeah, we have
little,
a good team.
I did. Bullfrog and Bomb. Great team.
Yes.
You're pros. But I asked her on Tuesday, give me the specifics on how that thing works. And I never heard that.
Well, you know, one of the...
So that's interesting.
So I'm going to tell you this.
A lot of money gets raised.
Well,
a lot
the question I would have is how much money goes to the...
Actually,
over the last 7 years, it's been over $7 million that's gone to... these various food charities, you know, food organizations like Share Our Strength, No Kid Hungry campaign.
Which is huge.
Which is a huge
especially
campaign.
Especially these days.
And Food Bank for New York City has been awesome.
Great.
Awesome part of New York City.
So 100% of the net proceeds from this gala weekend. And it takes place where? Yep. It used to be Chelsea Piers. Where is it now?
Well, you know, it's
all
in,
over.
It's in, it is all over. You'd have to check the website for the event, but we're doing an event that is on
the tailgate thing.
That's right.
We're Mario doing, tailgate.
That's right. We're doing
who's that?
Joe
who's
Namath.
Thank you.
You know, I love Mario,
no,
but
Joe,
I got to give it. It's Joe Namath and Mario Batali
Jets
hosting
fans,
Jets and chefs.
Team
yes.
has never been better.
Yes.
It was the golden era.
Yes.
He beat Johnny Unitas.
Yes.
Johnny Unitas, Mr. Old School, had high top black lace. I remember. I was a kid. How old are you? You were my age.
I'm old enough to have. That was a big thing. That was
we
huge.
Watched that game on
we
black and white
it.
Television
yes.
sets with little antennas
yes.
on. And Johnny U was an
yes.
old school quarterback for the Baltimore Colts, and he was just. And Joe Namath was this flaming, flashy guy from New York that was a good-looking guy, Broadway Joe.
Yeah.
Girls were lined up to see him everywhere. He did crazy, that nylon commercial.
He was crazy, but, you know, that was some great football.
Yeah.
And, you know, to have Joe Namath and Mario hosting this tailgate thing, there are 25 restaurants
right.
that are doing tailgate food, and, you know, there'll be, Joe Namath will be there, but also Joe Klecko is going to be there, Marvin Jones is going to be there. You know, these are great
where's
names.
It take,
Tony
where's
Richardson.
It taking place? Where?
This is on... Pier 92.
Which is where?
That is like 54th Street, 53rd Street,
one of them,
West Side.
One
yeah.
of them piers.
You know,
you
they
go to 57th
those...
Street and you go all the way down to the water and you find it.
It's, well, it's 50, like 53rd Street,
okay.
54th. You know, it's awesome because those piers are the cruise ship piers.
Yeah.
And they just either inside or outside. This is going to be outside. It's going to be a beautiful afternoon.
Okay.
Saturday, that'll be on the, I guess, the 18th of October.
So you're one of the participating chefs. It's
yeah.
a big, what are you doing? What's the dish you're making? Do you know yet?
We're doing a dry age burger. We're doing a tailgate burger
okay.
with a red onion jam with bacon.
You cooked a burger for me once on my TV yep. show. Was killer.
You know
your
what?
Burger's killer at the restaurant.
Well, you know, honestly, burgers.
Because you use dry age, you use the trim because you have a dry age
really,
program.
We use dry age,
and it has
meat.
That
That's
funky,
right.
wonderful smell that you
exactly.
and I are addicted to.
You know, you mentioned 21 when I was. That was my first chef job. The early 90s, and we were famous for a burger at 21.
Yeah.
They still are. But, you know, nobody talked burgers then at all. You wouldn't get a chef to admit they made a burger.
No, but I remember do you remember that pairing of Ann Rosenzweig and Alan Sayak? They were before or after you?
Well, no, I worked for both of them.
Oh, so they were like...
I was with them, and then... you know, everybody
so
left.
So I remember because Ann I love and Alan I love, they're two diametrically opposed personalities. They were like co-chefs, and they came up with a burger for the 21 Club that had some kind of compound butter in the middle.
It was incredible, though, because it's a great idea. It was Ann's idea to take a butter, make a compound butter with herbs, freeze it, and then take a slice of that frozen butter and stick it inside of a beautiful burger, and then they were, you know, and then grill it, right? So, but that, it didn't go over big with the regulars because it was a big change.
Yeah. And at the 21 Club, we don't do big changes.
Well, not that quickly.
I want my Cobb salad. Right. I want my Dover sole.
Chicken
I want
hash.
My wilted spinach and chicken hash.
You know, so, but I actually had a great time there. And we are today doing things that I've been doing now for over 20 years. So not only the burger, but now in the fall at Porterhouse New York, we start to do game. So we've been doing game now for a number of years. So we start featuring wild Scottish game, which is not as scary as it sounds. It's actually from, they're from game preserves in Scotland, and they're in the wild, but it's, they're harvested in on game preserves. So, but we do grouse and wood pigeon, and we'll do some hare later on in the season.
Are those, so, those stinky hares, when you bone them out, your hands get all smelly?
Yeah, that, you've got to cook them in red wine, just delicious.
I remember boning those out. Alan Saunders at Turin at Luca Carton. It was called Lièvre à la Royale.
So I was exactly.
And I remember boning that stuff out, and my hands would stink like that rabbit for days.
Alan Saunders, one of the great chefs.
One of the greats. One of the great.
One of the real greats. And you said before that Porterhouse is a chop house, and you're so right.
Thank you.
I mean, we really appreciate it because we have a whole range of steaks, but we do other things as well.
You do great fish. You do great sides. I mean, you could live on, I'm telling you.
But it's also what makes us happy.
And the room is beautiful, and it faces Columbus Circle, Central Park. There's not a bad seat in the house. Great wine service. I remember back in the day you had What's-Her-Name doing your wine.
Well, Brad Nugent is our wine director, and he's doing an awesome job.
You've always had a great wine program. What's-Her-Name?
Beth Van Benz was our first.
That's who I think actually.
We opened 8 years. We just had our 8th anniversary.
So give people, so we do our job correctly. Shill, where can people buy tickets for the New York Food and Wine Festival for your event?
I got to send them to the internet to look for the Food Network New York City Wine and Food Festival. Find the website.
Right. If you misspell anything, it'll self correct and it'll go right to
it. It's probably NYC. That's you're gonna find it. You'll find it. Just Google it. You'll find it. The New York City Wine and Food Festival.
It's a good thing. It's fun.
And
it's a
Jets
big party.
And Chefs is a fun one because it's in the afternoon and it's tailgate. So I expect there'll be families and you know, I'm really excited about meeting Joe Namath, Joe Willie.
Wouldn't be. My kid, there's a documentary on HBO. My kid must have watched it 20 times.
And he's done his mea culpas. He's paid his dues to society. He's, you know, we think he's clean and mean. So we like
it
that.
It was a different day in New York, and he was a great QB. And it was the last of the great Jets teams, really, sadly, for Jets and Mets fans, man. It's tough. I'm from Philly, so I can say this. People ask me, what sports are you for? I said, I don't, man. You grew up in Philly. Either you hit yourself in the head with a ball peen hammer for 40 years waiting for the Eagles to win. I mean, the Phillies, up until recently, had the worst record in professional sports, period. And the Sixers were always a player or two short of beating L.A.
But those cheesesteak sandwiches, man.
I boxed. I got revenge because we had a great boxing program. We had great boxers in Philly. Talk about the restaurant. What are you doing
now? That's true. Boxing is one of my favorite loves. I love boxing.
I didn't know that. We should go to a fight sometime.
Yeah. Oh,
I used to box at Gleason Gym. Teddy Atlas used to pay me to spar his fights.
When I was shooting, I did Epicurious. I filmed for 8 years Epicurious. I traveled all over. I used to bring my gloves with me and go to gyms and just work out with gloves.
Good for you.
Not kidding. Yeah.
So you worked with that team from Philly that did Epicurious.
Yes, that's correct.
I remember. Husband-wife team. Production.
Banyan Productions.
Banyan Productions.
Yeah, great people.
That's funny. Right. Small world, Michael.
Right. Yeah.
Son of a gun. He almost got my radio job, too. Wasn't enough to be a chef, you know? I was, like, unemployed at the time.
No, you know.
Little TV show, living on food stamps.
No.
And
you know what?
He's doing, he's killing. I'm cooking, like, how can this guy do a radio show and have a restaurant? It's not fair.
Cooking is, I love, you know, being in the restaurant with, you know, we have a great team of people. Mike and I have been cooking together for years. You know, we're a great team. It's a real collaborative effort. Yeah, I really enjoy being there. It's really what I love. It's what I love doing more than anything, being right here in New York and being in a restaurant.
It's a great restaurant. And I have to say, and I don't want to, you know, I mean, John George had very few missteps in his career. But that V Steakhouse was a genius. But V Steakhouse, which opened up upstairs, you guys got it right.
Well, we just try.
Kept it simple and do it right.
I'm there every day doing, I think, what is the the right thing for the, you know, for the audience.
You know what? Your onion rings are freaking great too.
We
I just thought about those onion rings. I just pictured like a big honking fat onion ring.
I wish I'd brought some for you, but you got to come.
No, you got to.
Because they don't travel well.
No, they don't travel well. Everything at Michael LaMonaco's Porter House is top notch. If you come to New York, my favorite steakhouses are Keen's and Michael LaMonaco's Porter House. And that's probably good. I guess you can go to Luger's for reference sake if you want to come to Brooklyn. But eat the steaks and skip everything else at Luger's. And bring wads of cash.
Well, you're very kind even to mention our name in that storied historical
I don't know. The guy that's coming on, Ryan Sutton says Luger's the best, but we'll argue about that on this microphone in a few minutes. Michael, thanks for coming
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much. Again, you can meet Michael in person at the tailgate party at the New York Food and Wine Festival. It's coming up in 2 weeks. It's a weekend affair.
October 16th to the 19th.
Right, and Mario Batali will be there. Joe Namath will be there. If that's not enough of a draw, I don't know what is.
Oh, there's 110 events. There's
110
really
events.
Really have a lot of events. It's
all
fantastic.
Around the city. It's a huge deal.
It's very cool.
Thanks for coming out.
Thanks for having
us. Staying in New York. Thanks for being part of this great community.
Great
Chef, thank you for coming out. My next guest is Laura Maniac. She is a master sommelier, and she and I are going to wax poetic about my favorite thing besides food. That's wine. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with Laura in a moment. So if you want to make a great tomato sauce, where do you start? You start with great canned tomatoes. And what are the best? What's the gold standard? What do the best Italian restaurants use, you think? San Marzano tomatoes from southern Italy. You know, I've heard of San Marzano tomatoes, loved them, heard the whole legend thing, knew they were delicious, but I wanted to go visit the region. So sometime back, I don't know, 06, 07, we went to San Marzano in the middle of the packing season in August. They've got a really long growing season. Starts early spring, April, May, and runs all the way through October because the weather down there is beautiful. You're along the coastline of Naples there in the shadows of Mount Vesuvius, and these are really small family farms, really small, like a half an acre apiece, and that's how they make a living, is harvesting these tomatoes. But what makes them great is the typicity of everything, the style of the tomato. It's kind of a long tomato with a really thin skin, super fleshy, super sweet tasting off the vine. We can Cento San Marzano tomatoes in the prime of the season, which is August. They just slow production down, hand pick everything. Those little basil leaves, yeah, they're all put in there by hand as well. It is the best canned tomato I've ever had, and you're going to love them too. There's a reason chefs love these things. They're San Marzano authorized from the beginning. The factory gets inspected every year. Hey, you want to make great tomato sauce at home? Start with great tomatoes. Cento San Marzano. That's what I use. Hey, folks. Mike Colomeco here. Years back when I had my own restaurant, I had to figure out what kind of oils to use, you know, try to make money in the restaurant business. So, you know, the most expensive oil wasn't the choice, but I had to use an oil that was great, an oil that I would use at home and also for my customers. Came upon Colavita olive oil, which to this day still stands head and shoulders above everybody in that extra virgin category in the supermarket shelves. So much of the extra virgin category is dominated by labels that sound like they're Italian. You know, they end with an O or something like that. But the truth is they're tank farm blends that come out of Italy, but what's in the jar or the can is oils from all over the world that are just bought on price. It's commodity oils. Colavita is the only one that's an extra virgin that's 100% Italian origin traceable. It's a great company. They really built their brand on the U.S. market. They get the U.S. market. So if you're looking for a super extra virgin olive oil, use the one that I've been using for years on my table at home and in my restaurants wherever I was hanging my chef's toque, and that would be Colavita Extra Virgin. True Italian, great oil. So my first trip to Portugal was 2013. It was a wine trip. A bunch of us flew over and toured the country top to bottom. Fell in love with the place. The food, the wine, the scenery, everything. Had to come back, which I did in 14 to film. And this time, 8 days in country, top to bottom again. Food, wine, surfing, what's not to love? If you've never been to Portugal, it's an extraordinary place. Buffered on one side by the Atlantic Ocean, you've got great seafood, great wines growing in all those regions. You go a little inland, you've got more great food, incredible wine country. Of course, Port is the birthplace of Ports up the Douro. But my takeaway was, I thought I'd had a lot of varietals. I could keep a list of 130, 135 varietals I've had over my life. Portugal has 250 of its own indigenous wine varietals, and they're killer good. A lot of them growing there for centuries. It has some of the oldest viticulture in Europe. The sparkling wines from the Bijada, the great reds coming down south from those regions. What's not to love? Crisp whites, beautiful full-bodied reds, port wine, sparkling wine. So if you're not familiar with the wines of Portugal, next time you spot by at your local wine store, ask about them. I love them. I'm drinking a lot of them these days, and I think you will too.
King Arthur Flour, established in 1790, is America's oldest flour company. They're an employee-owned company whose passion is sharing the joy of baking and inspiring bakers worldwide. When King Arthur was founded in 1790, George Washington was the newly elected president of the United States. The company was sold by the Sands family to King Arthur Flour employees in 1996. They are now an ESOP company, 100% employee-owned, with a 100% commitment to quality. Visit them at kingarthurflour.com.
Hello, this is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Hey, welcome back. This is Michael Lemeco, Michael Lemeco's Real Food. Hi, Mark Ladner. Congratulations on the 4 stars, dude. Del Posto is a great restaurant. But you're not on live with me today. Hey, my guest is Laura... Say it.
Manic.
Maniac. Oh, yeah. That means something in another language, maniac. Is that am I pronouncing it right?
Maniac.
Maniac. Okay, I'm not allowed to say that, FCC. Oh. But that would only be true if I were in Israel. Welcome.
Hi.
So we first met on the floor of Fiamma years ago.
We did.
When, what's his name was there? Fabio.
Fabio Tavolki.
And it was my only Steve Hansen restaurant that I liked because it was like the only one that had good. I mean, Steve's great. He's a pro.
Yeah.
He's one of the, I mean, him and Chattero really kind of, mm-hmm. If anyone knew how much money those guys generated and make, it's
crazy.
Sinful. But I didn't go to none of their restaurants because they're not my hang, not my kind of food. But that was the exception. And you were great. That place was great.
That was amazing. It was a great time.
And you are one of, and am I 139, 141, 100 and what?
141 master sommeliers in America.
Am I right? I'm
uh-huh.
close. 141
right.
master somms. Incredible. So let's just back to, when did you decide wine was going to be something you wanted to do?
So I passed my master's in 2009, but...
Way before that, though. When did you decide
yeah,
wine?
Yeah.
When did you get into wine? I mean, because you're
21
young.
Years old.
Why and how?
So 2001, I took a wine class at Windows on the World in the World Trade Center.
Kevin Zraley.
Yeah.
He and I worked together at Windows. I was the chef at Cellar in the Sky. He used to do wine pairings with me. He's such a cool guy.
He's so amazing. It was actually at Windows on the World, but it wasn't his course. But
okay.
it was in, you know, 103rd floor of the World Trade Center. Yeah. Amazing. It was July 2001.
Wow.
So the class starts Monday nights, 6 to 9. You take your classes. It's 18 weeks. I'm supposed to go to culinary school. I just took that class just because, like, I'm an overachiever. And I was like, oh, I'm bored. There needs to be something I'm learning. So I took that class kind of like, oh, I'll wait for culinary school to start in October.
Where were you going to go to culinary?
CIA.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, so I was registered. Everything was ready to go. And then took a wine class on, you know, just to fill time. And first day of class, I was kind of like, this is amazing. I can't believe they're talking about history and language and travel and culture. And I'm going to culinary school in 3 months. So whatever. I don't know what this is, but I'll just keep taking classes on Monday night until I have to leave to go to Hyde Park. And then, our last class was September 10th, that September 11th year. So...
Seriously,
that was the first wine class.
Whoa.
I took. I was 21 years old.
Why were you going to go to the CIA? Had you cooked? Had you worked in the restaurant business?
No. But I always loved hospitality. I'd been in the hospitality business since I was like 14. And
okay.
My parents weren't in restaurants or grandparents, but every Sunday, Italian supper, kind of like this big family overflowing. And it just really felt like the only way to like be in
who you were,
yeah,
and so, like what you were doing.
So yeah,
so you opted out of the CIA.
Yeah, you know, I never went. I mean, the whole world changed the next morning of September 11th, yeah. As we all know. Unfortunately,
so your course ended the 10th, the day.
No, 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 it didn't end. It ended officially there. It was supposed to end like October 1st, and so obviously after September 10th, the last course there, and then it kind of took a little break, of course,
right. like all of New York did,
right? Exactly. And so I withdrew from culinary school right away. It was just this weird time. Nobody knew. I was 21. Nobody knew what was going to happen.
I remember it was just, you know, it was dark. So then you got a gig from the house?
I was working for Steve Hansen at the time, as bartender, and actually it's the smallest, wonderful like world you can ever imagine, because I'm working at Ruby Foods. I'm supposed to go to culinary school. Then this whole thing happens. I decide I'm not going to go. And he comes in one day, Steve Hansen, and he's like, I'm opening a new restaurant in Times Square. It's called Bluefin. It's opening in December. It's, you know, brand new. I just hired the woman who used to run the wine program at Windows on the World. And her name is Inez Holdernez, and she's the most amazing woman ever. And she needs kind of like a cellar rat, an assistant sommelier. I know you're going to school for
this.
Should start. And so I did. And then
opening bottles every day, tasting
amazing
bottles.
So yeah, so
sitting
that was my
down
first
with her
job.
When the salespeople come in and do their little portfolio tastings.
And then she was supposed to take that job, you know, for forever or whatever. And right after, she just kind of like was not ready for a huge restaurant opening in the middle of Times Square with Steve Hansen. And especially after that tragedy, I mean, she only wasn't at work because she had her sister's wedding in North Carolina. It was this whole thing. So she like up and quit in February. And I was the only one that knew anything about where wine was.
Oh, lucky.
So they were like, would you like to be the wine sommelier for here? And I'm like, yeah, I guess. And so
So you took it. So that's amazing. That's just so ridiculously
right place, right time.
Completely. But that's life. That's often how life is.
Yep.
It's destiny sort of waits and taps you on the shoulder.
Always.
You plan and plan away, but the big shit's like, okay, you ready now?
Yeah, I mean, or you're not ready now.
Right, or you're not ready now.
Be ready.
It's how it's been for everyone's life that I know. Mm-hmm. The older I get, I more realize it's a big part of it. So we'll fast forward a bit. Did you do any wine education classes? Because there's a lot of that stuff out there now.
Yeah, and now
what kind of stuff did you do prior to testing for the master something, which is huge?
I mean, the master has four different levels. So before the master's exam, there's other, you know, exams. So
6 years.
So yeah, so it's about, you know, on average 8 to 10 years. It took me 6. So I took the intro, I took the advanced, I took the certified, all of those exams.
And when you look back historically, I was kind of, I mean, again, it was funny. I was working at the Four Seasons restaurant. It was my first job out of cooking school. So
nice.
January of 82, I'm working with Seppi Rankeli, daytime Four Seasons, nighttime entremetier. And my girlfriend at the time, wife now, was living with me in New York. She was I was a graduate. She was an intern. She was internshipping at the Maurice restaurant with Christian Delouvrier.
Wow.
Doing what all girls did back then, garmanger.
Of course.
Because either garmanger or pastry, because I think men thought you would explode on the hotline.
Yeah, we would melt.
Or melt or faint, or we didn't know. There were no women on the hotlines in New York then, period. So one of the idiot sous chefs and tournants tried to steal a ballotine from the restaurant one night to take to a party. They got busted because it's a hotel. You got to leave through the employees. So suddenly Christian needed a guy, and I got a gig. She said, well, my boyfriend works at the Four Seasons. He's a really good line cook. He's got a lot of experience before. So I ended up there. And what's the story about? It's not about me. When I got to the Maurice, luckily, so I worked two jobs. For 6 months, I worked daytime Four Seasons entremetier, nighttime entremetier at the Maurice. 18, 19 hours a day, 6 days a week. It almost killed me. And then Christian offered me the sous chef job. But our sommelier, and there was nobody else, I don't think any other restaurant had a somm back then. This is 1984.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Windows would have. Was Roger Daghorn.
Oh, no way.
So I got to know Roger when he was like a young man.
Uh-huh.
And Roger's dad was a chef.
Yep.
But here's my point. So Roger Daghorn was an early master somm.
Yeah, one of the few in New York.
And then when you look back historically, the program started in like the late 60s or 70s.
70s, yeah.
And for the first 20 years, there is not a woman's name.
Nope.
Who was the first one I remember?
Madeline Trefon.
Okay.
I believe it's Madeline Trefon.
I think so. Or the one,
it's Madeline.
Or somebody on the West Coast.
Sally Moore is the second one, and I think Madeline Trefon's the first for sure.
And then suddenly you see women's names popping up. And there's some years when 8 or 9 people pass on a big crop,
yep.
And there's some years when 2.
Yeah, well, we're 21 women worldwide now.
21 out of 150. Still nothing.
Very, very small amount.
And Pascaline, shout out to my good friend Pascaline Patier. This year got through.
Yes,
she's another rising star. All right, talk a bit about... Tell me about... So what was the hardest part of that test for you? Because it's... I mean, you have to really bore down. I mean, you almost have to be like...
You give up your life.
And it's totally academic. It's minutiae. It's soil types. It's fungus. It's polyphenols.
Yep.
It's all the shit that honestly has nothing to do with the enjoyment of drinking wine.
Well,
for
we have fun too, but...
I hope... Well, you have fun. Yeah. She's just like that. She's just like perky. Some of them... I was... what was the hardest part? Because at some point you have a blind tasting where they're pouring a mystery wine and you've got to nail it. What was yours?
Six wines blind is the blind tasting. Fuck. You nail the grape. You nail the vintage. You nail the region, the sub-region.
Folks, do you have any idea how hard this is? I mean, it's people that drink wine like me, and I drink wine every night. Mm. I'll do a blind tasting with a group, and if you get 5 to 10% right. Mm-hmm. That's a great day.
Oh, yeah.
Because you're clueless. I mean, you're just clueless. It's white, it's red, it's in the glass, and I'm not going to tell you shit. And unless something jumps out fast, or unless you're really good at this, it's like closing your eyes and walking in the dark.
No, it's true. I did a blind tasting yesterday, actually, at Cork Buzz in Chelsea.
So talk about your places, because you do this every... Is it every day in Chelsea you do this?
Yeah, every day from 4 to 7, we do blind tasting happy hour. And it's super fun. It's a flight of 3 wines. And, you know, I mean, you can get as dorky and into it as you want. I mean, if you just want to go and drink a flight of wine, you just go and you don't have to guess. But the idea is a little bit of competition.
You have to. Because if you get one right, you're like, I got it. I knew it was a Sauvignon Blanc. I got it because it really reeked of Kapis.
Yeah. It's totally true. So, but I taught it last night for a bunch of Googlers. Google came in. They did a tour. It was really fun.
Oh, they were nerded out.
They were excited. They were like, this is the coolest thing. I can't believe you guys can do this.
So you did 6 wines on the test, and
you got them all right.
Country of origin, varietal, and vintage.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there was a little bit of, you know, if it's 95 Barolo and it's 96, you call, okay, you get it, because they're so similar. But if you call 96 and it's 97, you're not getting the point, because they're too different of a vintage, you know? So you asked about the difficult part. For me... I love the blind tasting, and I never struggled with it. So I'm sure, you know, I could have a bad day, but I was naturally a good taster, or so it seemed. I passed
She's naturally a good taster.
I passed the tasting at 24. I mean, it was my first time I ever took the Masters was London, and at the Dorchester, I was one of 2 people that passed the tasting exam that year. And it was in another country, so it was a somewhat intimidating, you know, British kind of organization. But I struggled with the service, which is crazy to me to think. Service is a practical.
Yeah,
so you wait on, you know, fake guests, but those guests are master sommeliers. So it's a little bit of theater. It's a little bit of, you know, the art of hospitality. And then it's also like, how do you get out of your own way? Which was my struggle. Like, I don't belong. I'm not good enough yet. Or so I thought. And so, you know, I might have had just as much knowledge when I passed as when I wasn't passing. But I just thought, like, I woke up in the morning, like, almost in tears, just like, oh, I'm never going to pass this exam. I'm not. And so I got to the table and I was like this, like, you know,
nervous
like little
wreck.
Girl. And so the year I finally passed, I got a performance coach and I, like, watched myself on video. And I, like, literally, like, mind over matter, you know, and I just finally was like, screw that. I'm not going to let this exam
get
me.
When
you believe. And so for some people, it's theory. They have to just buckle down and study. And they're like, oh, I don't know. Need to know this. And so they think they don't. And then they don't. Other people, it's tasting. Other people, it's service. For me, it was all about nerves and service and the feeling of not being good enough. So.
Well, you were good enough, obviously, and you're great. So 2 places in town. Cork Buzz was your first. You opened up. It is a wine bar restaurant.
Yeah, it's a full restaurant. We're open. So Cork Buzz, the first one is in Union Square. It's
12th?
13th. So 13 East 13th.
Okay, that's easy to remember.
Yeah.
North side of the block, that much I know, mid-block.
Exactly.
Step upstairs to get onto it.
Totally.
Into it.
Exactly.
And every night you're going to find full-on menu, small plates to do, great wines by the glass, total wine program, and
absolutely,
everyone on the floor. And then the second place just opened up.
Yes, Chelsea Market.
Chelsea Market, right across from Jake Dixon, so on that south side of the marketplace. Mm-hmm. Wonderful little kitchen in there. And again, just simple foods paired to match with wines by the glass.
Exactly. I mean, there's a full bottle list there, too. And both places have liquor, you know, so you can...
And one of my the reason I love to, we've done years ago, I remember being in Paris and going to like Willy's and the Lecluse and the early wine bars of the '80s that were, because they kind of started in London, then they moved to Paris. And I remember, and of course the wine scene there was so much better then because we couldn't get a lot of those wines.
It's true.
Now it's completely flipped around. Now the wine scene in America is on fire.
It's true.
I think it's the hottest on the planet. But the reason I love to do shows about wine bars and talk about wine on these shows isn't that I'm some kind of purported expert. I'm not. I'm just a wine drinker who enjoys it. But to demystify the whole wine thing, because it can get geeky. And so I think wine bars are just the greatest place to do that, because you can show up with a couple of friends, pick 7 or 8 or 9 plates of food, and go through between the three of you a dozen to 15 different, you know, everyone gets a different glass, and taste and just comment. What did I like? And just kind of remember, what did you like? And then develop a palate and drink what you like and learn.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, wine bars are, you know, essentially specializing in wine. So if you get a good wine bar, you can try everything from Aglianico to Zabibo. You know, you have all these different grapes, and maybe you don't even know what one grape is, but because that's what we specialize in, you know, you have an opportunity to really teach yourself. And hopefully, like in our places, we have a great staff that it's empowering in a way that we teach is kind of like, all right, come on in. We're just friends chatting about wine, instead of being like, well, wait a minute. There's all this mystery in wine and you don't know anything, so you need me. That's not really our approach. Our approach is the opposite. Like, all right, how about this? Try this. Do you like this? Okay, great. Then you'll also like this. So it's a really fun thing to do. And it's been exciting to see a new... You know, I have a lot of great people on my team. And so I kind of take a step back and run the business, and then they're doing the wine thing and they're excited. And it feels really good. It feels like giving people the opportunities that I had when I was studying coming up in the wine world. So,
and kudos to like this younger generation, because I think old people tend to just shit on everything it is. You know, we invented that, or it was better when I... No. This young kids today, there's like that 35 and... That's what I'm calling young kids. 35.
Yeah,
they're so into wine. So into wine. It's crazy. Like, I'll see these 20-something. I'm going to take a look at Joey Campanelli. Joey.
Oh, my God, yeah.
I mean, Joey looked... The first time I met Joey, he looked like I would card that kid.
Uh-huh.
You're not 21, and maybe he wasn't. But, I mean, he just got into wine in Italy, and there's a whole generation of young kids that go out to restaurants who are so knowledgeable about wine, I am shocked. A whole generation of young Americans who are just on it. So
it's great.
Just going to keep getting better.
Yep.
All right, you can visit Lara's restaurant, Cork Buzz, 13 East 13th Street, just south of Union Square, or the Chelsea Market, which I'm a really big proponent of shopping in. Jake Dixon's got great meat there. The Lobster Place is the best seafood store in the city, bar none. Amy's Bread, all sorts of stuff going on, and you can visit her. What's the name of it there?
Cork Buzz.
Cork Buzz as well. Easy to do. All right.
Easy.
Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure. So nice
to be
here.
Pleasure. Thanks for coming on. I'll see you next week.
Sounds great.
Be well.
Bye.
All right, my next guest is Ryan Sutton, who is one of the three new food critics for Eater. He'll be on in just a moment to talk about what he does. Stay tuned.
Hey, what's up? This is John Norris, and you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network.
Ryan first came on my radar when he was the food critic for Record at Bloomberg, where, how many years?
I was there for 8.5 years.
Damn, gee, that's a long time.
That's a long time in internet years, especially.
Yeah, that's like 3 dog lifetimes. That's huge. And then, for those of you that must know this, Ryan Sutton, Eater just has blown up. You know, it started in New York, didn't it? Started in New York with Lockhart Steel and...
That's right, yeah. Lockhart Steel and Ben Leventhal.
And just blew up as the food scene blew up. It was like perfect timing, and... But one thing Eder said in the beginning, we're not going to be food, we're not going to do this thing called food criticism. And then as it just got bigger and bigger, and I guess the space filled, and they just decided, you know, we could probably use a couple of people to do restaurant reviews for us. So last year, anyone that was in the scene got that little email that Eder was looking for taking applications for three different kinds of critics, and they must have gotten a shit ton of response. And Ryan nailed one of the gigs, and Robert Seitzema, who's a old friend of mine, who you have to get him in touch with me because I want him on this show.
Absolutely.
I have not seen him. I used to live on Abingdon Square, and he lived on Bleecker, and we would bump into each other. It was nice, but now I have some old email address. So I don't know if it works, but talk about this, because this is huge. You're getting to write, and by the way, kudos from Michael LaMonaco, who reads your reviews, who used to read you on Bloomberg, and now you're getting a longer form to play with, and plus some other stuff, like Suttonomics. Talk about what a week in the life of Ryan Sutton, food critic for Record, of the New York scene at Eater is, because that's cool and that's deep.
It is cool, and I'm really fortunate that
All jealous.
As you should be, because it's a fun place to work. No, but it's also a tough life when you're. It's obviously you eat at a restaurant and you're accountable for that meal you consume. It just doesn't go one in end and out the other, so to speak. You have to produce. And so my week more or less starts, I like to think, on Wednesdays. Wednesday is a good place to start because my review is already out, and Wednesdays and Thursdays where I spend the bulk of my day working on Suttonomics, which is my data column that takes a close look at usually the prices of the restaurant industry. And that's something I bought not just from Bloomberg, but from a blog I run called The Price Hike. And I've always been extremely diligent and extremely passionate about exposing what we pay for the expensive food that we eat. Because when you get these press releases from the restaurants or when you learn about these restaurants, there's always a lot to be said about this good or that particular good, except for the price, which is the most important thing. I remember the first time I ate at a WD-50. It was one of the first big expensive meals I ever had. And I really liked it. Back then, the dinner was $95. I think the wine pairing was $145. This was in, I believe, November of 2005. Went back home. I was living with my father in Long Beach. And he said, how was dinner? I said, it was great. And the second question he asked me was, well, how much did it cost? I said, for me, after tax and tip, about $180. And he didn't talk to me for the rest of the night. And I've told that story before, but I tell it again because, you know, prices, we tend to forget about them sometimes, but they mean so much to the people who, A, can afford them, and B, especially the people who can't afford them. And so that's why I focus, that's why I have that column, Suttonomics, to focus on prices and to kind of engage in some sort of dialogue between the chefs, asking them why they charge what they do for, you know, a variety of goods. And so
we'll get back to that, because you did a couple of the recent ones that I just thought, obviously, my little homeworks before I do you. Let's go on and see what you've written about recently. So we'll talk about the $25 Caesar salad at Parm.
Of course.
And a brand of scotch that I didn't even know existed.
Johnny Walker Blue.
I don't hang out at those kinds of places. Obviously, I'm giving up my age and my lifestyle. I've never heard of Johnny Walker Blue, but we'll talk about that later. So that's your Wednesday-Thursday thing. It's written on Suttonomics.
That's my Wednesday-Thursday thing. Friday is a largely administrative day. I'm doing a lot of fact checks for my upcoming column. And of course, I'm eating out 4 to 5 nights a week.
Okay.
Saturday is my rest day. And Sunday is when I do the bulk of my writing. I do the bulk of my writing exclusively in Long Beach, which is I split my time between Long Beach and Manhattan.
So do you surf?
I don't surf. I am a third generation speed skater. I'm actually a winter sports guy.
Dude.
So I'm a speed skater, but I do a little working out on the boardwalk, and I write for about 9 hours on Sundays. And we all cook, you know, the Sutton family all cook a big old Sutton family dinner, usually a little roast beef or roast pork, hamburgers, hot dogs, watch a little Sunday night football. And then Monday, I edit, and Tuesday, my column comes out. So that's my week in a nutshell. And again, in addition to being in the office for about 8-9 hours a day, I'm also eating out 4 to 5 nights a week.
When you eat out, I mean, the Times is sort of, to this day, like it or not, still considered the 900-pound gorilla, the gold standard in the city. And the protocol for the Times has been historically that the critic with company most of the time must visit a restaurant 3 times prior to doling out stars. your couple of visits, one visit, two visits, how does it work for you guys?
Three is the magic number for me, but it varies from restaurant to restaurant. And let me give you an example. If, let's say I decided to re-review 11 Madison Park. I reviewed them from Bloomberg. I went 3 to 4 times. Eating there 3 times over the course of 2 months would not do either me or the reader very good, in my opinion, because while the menu would change a little bit from day to day, it wouldn't change a whole lot. And if I actually went ahead and did what I did at Bloomberg, eat at the restaurant 3 to 4 times over the course of a year so I could get a different season, then I think you're waiting a little too long for the reader. You're keeping too much in your own little kangaroo pouch. And so I think there's a better way to go about reviewing certain restaurants. For some of these fine dining restaurants, I rather just go once or twice and say, hey, this is what they're doing right now. It's a 4-star caliber, and maybe let me go back in a year and see how they've changed. That's an exception, though. For the most part, for new restaurants, like Huertas, for example, I just reviewed them.
You and the Times in 1 week.
On 1 week.
Bang, bang.
And so I went 3 times recently, and I went 1 time earlier in the summer. So it's about 4 times altogether. Two visits for the prefix menu they offer, and 2 visits for the a la carte menu that they offer. Mm. But generally speaking, 3 is the magic number. But it's not so much a rule as what's the best way to tell this story. We're not local New York critics. We're not Michelin inspectors. And what the Michelin tries to do,
don't get me started about Michelin.
Fair enough, and it's something we can disagree on. I actually don't mind a lot of what they do, and I respect their effort at objectivity, even though it can't be achieved in this field. I don't like the fact that they don't write criticisms because they eat so much and they have so little to say. And I know they're smart people and smart inspectors working there, and I wish they could do full-fledged criticisms instead of just writing stars. But generally speaking, you know, they go to a place a few times and they try to be very objective about it. Listen, there is no such thing as objectivity in food criticism. It's storytelling. It's journalistic storytelling backed up by facts and observations. And so I'm not going to have a set number for each particular restaurant, but generally speaking, 3 is the magic number. But I will let the storytelling and the journalistic facts dictate what I do rather than some arbitrary number.
All right. Can I order a pizza? Did I order a Millennium Falco pizza? I'm ordering my pizza online. This is we're breaking news at Heritage Radio here. Yeah, I'm ordering a pizza while I'm doing the show because it's important. The reason I said that about Michelin, I'm way old, so I grew up in working in New York restaurants when it was the Times and maybe the New York Magazine. It was the second biggest thing. And I used to go to Europe all the time, and they got it. I mean, Michelin was the gold standard for France and for the mostly Europe. When they came to the States, it was their first kind of foray out. New York, I think, was one of the first cities that they did. I knew the guy that ran it. I had him on WR when he was on the radio show. I think I actually did a big PR event at Barnes & Noble for this first or second guide. And I really got the sense then, it's gotten a bit better, but my sense then, they wouldn't admit it, was they brought a bunch of French people in to review New York restaurants, and they just didn't get New York. They didn't get the zeitgeist. They didn't get what New York is about. It isn't France. It isn't Paris. Why are you bringing in French critics? And their answer was that was the only people we had trained to do this.
And they admitted as much to me when this guide came out. You know, when I talked to Michael Ellis, the new director, the old one was Jean-Luc Noray.
That's who I used. Jean-Luc was a very charismatic guy. But it smelled of global branding.
Of global branding. And, you know, why do New York restaurants like Aquavit or Flidia, why did they not get Michelin stars, you know, the first go-around? And those were 2 celebrated restaurants back then. But lo and behold, 10 years later, Aquavit has not 1 but 2 stars. Flidia's still not on there. I haven't dined there recently, admittedly. But you have a lot of more New Yorkness to the guide. You have more, for lack of a better term, ethnic restaurants, which is the general purpose term we can use sometimes for foods that are not Japanese, French,
If I want New York
Italian.
Criticism, you know where I'm going to go? To you. I'm going to go to guys like you and Seitz that have been walking these streets, that know this town, that know the context, that know the history. I don't need Michelin. Sorry.
And I think a lot of people agree with you, and I agree with you as well to a certain extent. From a global perspective, it's nice to be able to go to, say, Japan, and without reading the local critics, to pick up a guide and say, these 3 stars supposedly mean the same thing as 3 stars in America. But yes, I'm with you on the larger point, because what Michelin does is offer a number, 1-star, 2-star, or 3 stars, whereas critics offer a dialogue, critics offer storytelling. And that's what I think ultimately readers want. They don't want a number. They want a vicarious experience at lunchtime to say, hey, let me just live through the eyes of this critic. And maybe if I like living through the eyes of this critic for 5 minutes during my lunchtime while I read her review, maybe I'll actually go to this restaurant. And that's where the servicey aspect of criticism comes.
You're right.
Play.
And
I like this. I don't like that.
Ryan, you completely nailed it. I remember having Frank Bruni on as a guest at WOR, and he pretty much said what used to be 8 or 9 years ago. But talked about how it used to be more of a service. Food criticism way back in my day, 70s, 80s, and it was a way for a person of whose opinion you respected to say this place is worth going to, because New York restaurant scene was tiny back then. This is worth it. This isn't. This is worth your money. This isn't. And now it's become much more entertainment with some service value. But people read these reviews. A lot of the times, readership now is outside of New York, reading NewYorkTimes.com.
The storytelling is the key. No one's going to remember 5 years from now whether Robert Sietsema or Ryan Sutton or Pete Wells thought the steak was overcooked or undercooked. What they're going to remember is why they argued that Minetta Tavern was one of the most important new steakhouses because of their techniques and their sourcing and the ambiance and the celebrity-like culture of the restaurant. That's storytelling, and that's context. That's facts. At Bloomberg, they always taught me, you know, opinions are cheap, facts are expensive. And I believe that still to this day to a certain extent. And it's that factual storytelling that drives the bulk of the review. Not to discount the fact that, you know, certain restaurants serve bad food and you have to tell it, but it's only within the context of the story. Because otherwise, you know what? You're just writing a Yelp, review.
So we both discovered, I live downtown, Lower East Side, Grand Street, and Co-op Village. So I'm always a proponent of my neighborhood. I used to live in the West Village. I mean, downtown, the rest of the restaurant scene is just so deep. You know, West Village, the East Village, and Lower East Side. So Root and Bone opens up, and I happen to bicycle down Third Street. That's just my way. Every morning I work at the New York Athletic Club. I bike out of my street. I make a left-hand turn at Avenue C and 3rd. I take 3rd to 2nd Avenue, and I go north to 20, blah, blah, blah. So I watch this place sort of being built by hand. There's just people. And what is Root and Bone? It was a clothing store or another hipster dinner. And they opened up, and I finally went there a couple of weeks ago early because they get mad busy and they don't take resis, and did a lot of the chicken. They had a homemade biscuit with a boneless breaded chicken thigh center. It was so... And then I had the chicken and waffle. I mean, is that not some of the best fried chicken you've ever had?
It is, in my humble, subjective, critical opinion, the best, at least new fried chicken being served in New York City right now. Not everyone likes it because they do something interesting. In addition to serving a regular fried chicken, they take the bird and they brine it in sweet tea. Yeah. And so it gives it a little bit of naturally sweetness. Not everyone likes that in a chicken breast. I do because I've always believed, first of all, I love chicken breast. A lot of people like to poo-poo on it, but I like to think of it as the neutral tofu of the carnivorous worlds. And it can take on so many flavors so beautifully. And I think sweet tea works there. I think the crust of the chicken, the outside is absolutely beautiful. It's not as dense as a hardcore southern skillet fried chicken.
It's a pressure fryer. It's not cast iron.
It's a pressure fryer. It's not cast iron.
Right.
And, of course, the money ingredient is a little bit of lemon dust that they put on at the end. And it gives it this just gently citrus, I don't want to say sweetness or even necessarily sourness. It's just a beautiful brightness that imparts to this rich bird. It's almost like the gourmet version of the exterior in a Sour Patch Kid without being a sour.
It's great. It's great. Now, back to your Suttonomics, because it's great to read. Again, my guest is Ryan Sutton. He is the one of three critics of record for Eater, but he specializes in New York and actually is doing some great stuff on the high end of the New York scene. So how did Parm justify the $25 Caesar freaking salad?
To be fair, it's Carbone.
Carbone.
Not at all. And Carbone, of course, for those who don't know, is one of New York's most expensive Italian-American restaurants.
A sticky old school, the way you're dressed, like Brooklyn 1970s.
Yeah, they definitely have a strong Jersey Brooklyn vibe going on with the waiters. The red Zach Posen tuxedos. They look like, you know, Joe Pesci from My Cousin Vinny. And they use or they serve a lot of expensive things. I believe the veal parm is $55. I think the veal marsala is around $54 if you want Lobster Fra Diavolo, you're going to spend close to $100. And of course, perhaps most shockingly to some people, is the fact that they serve a pretty expensive salad, a Caesar salad, which costs $21, which is pretty expensive for lettuce and croutons and anchovies. Yeah. And the question you have to ask yourself is this better than all the other Caesar salads I've had in New York? And for the most part, with one exception, you know what? I'd actually say yes. I think it ties with the Breslin's. The Breslin's isn't cheap either. I think it costs anywhere from $14 to $16. But $20 is a high psychological price point for a salad that doesn't have a steak on top of it. But again, listen,
what is your number one Caesar salad then?
I would say it's a tie between Carbone and the Breslin. But again, what these guys do, I think, is important and delicious, is that they're taking a cuisine, the Italian-American cuisine, which is always viewed as cheap, even though it, you know, is an expression of, you know, post-war abundance in the 50s and 60s. They took a cuisine that was viewed as cheap and, for lack of a better term, ethnic, and they made it fancy, and they got themselves a Michelin star, and they just serve great food, and I respect that. And to me, that really is the future of food, taking cuisines that are viewed as cheap by some, whether it be Mexican or Bolivian or Russian, and trying to do something fancy and nice with it. It works sometimes, it doesn't other times, but I that's the risk of moving food forward, and I think they took a justifiable risk at Carbone.
Yeah, those guys, they're I mean, I loved Teresi the first couple times. That restaurant was just brilliant. Those guys led the box. A minute and a half to go. Worst meal in the past year, best meal in the past year?
Oh, gosh. Worst meal of the last year. Part of me wants to say
Tavern on the Green,
just because, well, I just think that's intuitive. It just makes sense. It's Tavern on the Green, and they just didn't get it right. If you want the details, you can read my review, but it's not worth recounting too much of it since the chef has left. Best meal of the last year, it's hard to say. Listen, you know, as much as I love the fancy tasting menu restaurants, because I write about them so much, and I really do love the Ateras and the Blancas, and I think Blanca and Atera, it's two of the best restaurants in New York right now, along with the Chef's Table at Brooklyn Fair. I love those fancy 20-course menus, because I have a little bit of culinary ADD, but if I could pick a best meal, you know, just hanging out with my parents at Roberta's or the Breslin or Lavara in Brooklyn, three of our favorite restaurants, all small plates. And just a great way to understand a menu. I don't believe in the old appetizer, entree, dessert format. I think you should build your meal out of a collection of places. And restaurants like Roberta's and the Breslin and Lavara help you do that.
Great answer. So my guest is Ryan Sutton. First time he's been on this show. Obviously, it won't be the last. He's a great interview. You can read his work weekly. Well worth it. If you live in New York and you go out to eat, it's another opinion that matters. If you're coming to New York and you're listening to What's Out of Town, it's another opinion that matters. And, oh, by the way, I never shill for myself, but I keep forgetting to do this. I've got a PBS show that's 14 years now on TV, and we're on Create TV, which is a PBS platform that's national. We're now in 80% of U.S. households. So if you like this show and you wanted to see me on TV, go to your Create schedule. We're on 3 times a day, 6 days a week. Or you can watch me on Channel 13's website, because now they stream it. So that's my shilling for me. Back to Ryan. Ryan Sutton's work can be found at Eater in New York. It's all, just Google his name, and it's everything he's written in the last 6 months, and it just keeps going back. It's really funny, really informative. We never got to that silly blue scotch, but I don't really care much about that anyway. That's for somebody else in the meatpacking district. Welcome. Keep up the great work. Thanks, and we'll get you back in here in a couple of months again.
Thank you, Michael. I appreciate it.
You're listening to Michael Michael's Food Talk. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Stay tuned. If you like this program, you can always join the network or donate. It's a great bunch. These guys pretty much invented this food streaming radio space. Almost 50 shows now, 7 days a week. Doesn't get much cooler. See you next week, folks.
Whoa, oh, oh. Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.